From everything I heard about the Colonel, he had been a brilliant guy with a photographic mind. The one person I happened to meet and took quite a shine to, and he to me, was Dr. Adolf Rohm. He was 83 years old, was originally from Switzerland, was on the first A-bomb test team in the US, and knew Dr. Robert Oppenheimer personally. One night after supper and after a few martinis, I jokingly asked Adolf, "What do you know about the little grey men that are supposedly on ice here at Wright-Patterson?" Even though I had a top secret clearance, there were areas at Wright-Patterson that were off limits and may have held some bodies. Who knows what they held? I distinctly recall his face turning ashen white, his voice got very stern, and he said, "Arn, all I can tell you is that they were not weather balloons, and we will not talk about it again. Do you understand?" And we never spoke about it again. Testimonial. Colonel Ross Didrikson, U.S. Air Force. I was a staff officer for the Military Liaison Committee between the chairman of the EC, Atomic Energy Commission, and the Secretary of Defense. I became acquainted with not only the Army, Navy, and Air Force, but civilian agencies, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and other contacts which I developed. During that period of time, one of my functions was to accompany a security team which visited all of the nuclear facilities to check on the security of weapons. We were getting reports of visits by UFOs over the storage facilities and even some of the manufacturing facilities. And that went on continuously. These overflights of nuclear facilities were taken very seriously. In fact, they were taken so seriously that the observers would often deliberately not report them because it involved so much bureaucracy and protocol. On most of those cases where the UFOs became identified on radar, they would try to scramble aircraft to intercept them. It was a very aggressive response from our own government. The famous flyover the Capitol happened in July of 1952. During that incident, I saw 9 illuminated disc-type craft. After that event, I was assigned to the Unified Command under Admiral Felt as the officer in charge of the alternate command post involved with nuclear weapons operation planning. I maintained contacts with NORAD, with the SAC operations, and was involved with operational plans for the use of nuclear weapons. I also learned of 2 incidents which happened involving UFOs and nuclear weapons. The first happened after we exploded a nuclear weapon over the Pacific. This was in 1961, I believe. The consternation that it elicited from the ETs was because it shut out communications over the Pacific Basin for a number of hours in which no radio transmission was available at any time. The extraterrestrials were really concerned about this detonation because it affected our ionosphere. In fact, the ET spacecraft were unable to operate because of the pollution in the magnetic field. The second incident took place either at the very end of the 1970s or the early 1980s when we attempted to put a nuclear weapon on the moon and explode it for scientific measurements. This was not acceptable to the extraterrestrials. The ETs destroyed the weapon as it went toward the moon. The idea of any explosion of a nuclear weapon in space by any Earth government was not acceptable to the extraterrestrials, and that has been demonstrated over and over by the destruction of any nuclear weapon we sent into space. Testimonial. Merle Shane McDo, U.S. Navy Atlantic Command. McDo entered the Navy in 1978 and gained a top secret, Special Compartmented Intelligence, SCI, clearance with a zebra stripe badge. I enlisted in the United States Navy in August of 1978 and was assigned to the USS America. Unfortunately, I sustained some injuries on the flight deck while performing my duties. I then went to CNT Fleet, Atlantic Command Support Facility in Norfolk, Virginia, where I was assigned to OSF, Division 22. Back then we were a group of about 11 people directly responsible for briefing Admiral Tran, who was the Commander-in-Chief, Atlantic Command. We briefed him on current military operations around the world, what the Soviets were doing that day, what they had done the night before, etc. Everyone on the Eastern Seaboard answered to this man. After a 6-month wait, I got a top secret, Special Compartmented Intelligence, SCI, clearance, with a zebra stripe identification badge, which permitted unrestricted access to any facility at any time, as well as the command center, to which it was specifically assigned. My station was up on the mezzanine, or the third deck as we called it, over the command center. My job was to make sure that any incoming and outgoing audio, video information that came into the command center was recorded and duly logged for reference in case they needed it later. I recorded all of the video and audio. Even when they called a Condition Zebra alert. Condition Zebra is the highest level of alert that the Navy has or had at that time. It is generally used when dealing with global nuclear threats, in particular the Soviets. Soviet Bearcats were routinely patrolling up and down the eastern seaboard watching what we were doing. We would set a Condition Zebra if we had the need to put planes in the air to escort the Bearcats out of the area if they were a little too close to our airspace or if they had ships in the area that were acting suspicious. We'd also have a drill where they would get out the books to wage nuclear war. The watch officer and the junior watch officer, the JUD, had keys to a safe and they would get these books out called the Mad Books. Mutual Assured Destruction. And they would have the codes that were necessary to transmit to the submarines if necessary, to launch a nuclear strike. Not many people were allowed in the command center when that was going on because they actually did use the codes. Their Zebra classification, without that you were not allowed authorized access to these facilities during this drill. And their Zebra drill was specifically for the highest level of top secret information that was being exchanged between the command center and ships and or submarines at sea. All of which leads me to the UFO incident, which took place in May of 1981. The day started out pretty routine when they dimmed the lights. They did this first in the command center when they set a Condition Zebra alert. Most of the time when they set these drills they would say, "This is a drill. This is a drill. Set Condition Zebra." But they turned the lights down this time and they didn't say, "This is a drill." And the watch officer and the junior watch officer looked at each other and told some of their assistants to verify whether or not this was a drill as the event was taking place. And the early warning system. I believe it came in from an Air Force base in Greenland or Nova Scotia at the time. Said that we had contact with an unidentified flying object that had entered our airspace. They said that this was not a drill and so it was treated with the utmost promptness and everyone started running around like mad once they realized that it wasn't a drill. It took on a whole different air. When you set a Condition Zebra, whether it is a drill or not, people who do not have a Zebra access badge must leave the command facility. We have Marines stationed inside and outside the building who were under orders to shoot any unauthorized personnel that remained in the command center during one of these episodes. That was for the interest of national security. I recall one time when a Condition Zebra was called and the Marine comes in and wants to know what is going on. Is this a drill or not, because they have orders to start shooting people. I got the junior ROUD's attention and said, "Hey, you guys need to tell this guy something. He is ready to start shooting people." I remember wanting to just get the hell out of there because he came in there and he said, "You have got a minute or two. If I don't find out something, he was ready to come in there and start shooting people, destroying evidence." But this event was not a drill. The watch officer summoned Admiral Tran over to the command center because this was a little out of his area of authorization and required Admiral Tran's oversight. And within minutes Admiral Tran was rushed into the command center into his viewing booth that he had right under the mezzanine. The first thing he wanted to know was how many contacts we had, where they were, which direction they were going, and were the Soviets responding. We knew that it wasn't the Soviets that had entered our airspace. That was verified from the start. Admiral Tran gave authorization to put two planes up to go see what this thing was. That was when the chasing up and down the eastern seaboard began. We launched planes from as far north as Greenland and as Naval Air Station, Oceania. We had this object on radar almost an hour. You could hear the pilot's live voice transmissions being piped into the command center. They had visual confirmation and made descriptions of the object. Pilots were able to close a couple of times and were able to see that the object was like nothing that we had or that the Soviets had. That was determined very quickly. This vehicle or whatever it was that they were chasing showed very erratic flight up and down the coast. Very quick flight. For instance, it would be off the coast of Maine and would leave the airspace in that area so fast that we had to send planes out of Dover Air Force Base just to pick it up, just in what seemed like moments. I know for a fact that it would take an F-14 probably 30 minutes to traverse that much distance, but this object, whatever it was just popping up. 1 minute it was here and the next minute bam, it was several hundred miles down the coast, just playing tag. It went all the way down to a point off the coast of Florida around Mayport, the naval air station that we have down there at Cecil Field. That was before it turned and took what would have been an easterly direction from our vantage point back up towards the Azores before we lost track of it. During all this, we were gathering information using KH-11 satellites, which have a very high capability of taking really good photographs of things literally within a few feet of the ground from a vantage point out in outer space. They were trying to get the KH-11 satellite to track this thing to get some photographs of it. The only photographs we did get back in the command center came from the first encounters that the planes had with the UFO off of the northern North American coast. I remember the shape was more like a cylinder. It was quite flat and long with abrupt ends that didn't taper down like most aircraft. You could clearly tell that it was metallic. And the pilots were giving information such as it was not leaving behind a vapor trail, no discernible lights or markings on it, no cockpit windows or doors, nothing like that. It just seemed to be one solid thing whatever it was. What was really bugging Admiral Tran? What was really driving him nuts, was this thing absolutely had complete control of the situation and could be anywhere that it wanted to be in a matter of seconds. 1 minute we were closing on it off the coast of Maine, the next it is in Norfolk heading south toward Florida. I would describe the officers as being scared. Admiral Tran was usually a very calm man, you never really saw him lose control or raise his voice or get excited about anything. But this really got him upset. The UFO was moving around so erratically and so quickly up and down the coast while we were trying to notify as many commands as we could to get a plane up. They would actually not track it, it would just appear hundreds of miles from the last sighting. Admiral Tran was scrambling and authorizing planes left and right up and down the entire eastern seaboard to try and cut this thing off. It was clear that they wanted to force it down by whatever means possible and recover it. They wanted it and they wanted it bad. When this event ended, the object headed out over the Atlantic. I remember them saying that it pulled up at a 66 degree angle as it approached the Azores without slowing down. It left the atmosphere and was gone into space. You are talking about something that covered thousands of miles in a blink of an eye and it was just gone and left everyone sitting around scratching their heads. Gee whiz, I wonder what that was. It was comical in a way to see how the vast military might of the United States was put on its knees by something. They had no idea what it was, where it came from, where it was going or anything. The only thing that they knew for sure was that it wasn't the Soviets. The thing was, if this object had been hostile and wanted to drop weapons or shoot missiles at us, or whatever, it would have been very easy for them to do that. We didn't have anything at that time that could hold a candle to whatever this was. And it just had its own free run of our airspace and could do anything it wanted as far as traveling. We did not pose any threat to it whatsoever. Anyway, we secured from conditions Ebra. They turned the lights up and everyone was sitting around talking about it down on the command floor. I am up here by myself on the third deck. Admiral Tran is down here in his briefing area. They stayed for a few minutes before they left. I made a note of it in my logbook like you had to do. Then I really didn't give it much more thought. Later, these two guys in suits came in, wearing visitors' badges. You could tell they weren't regular personnel. They escorted me downstairs to the first floor where there were several little conference rooms. They took me into one that they already set up and sat me down. I could see they had my logbook. The suits began to question me about this event. They were being pretty rough about it, to be honest with you. I remember literally putting my hands up and saying, "Wait a minute, fellows. I'm on your side." They were very intimidating and made it quite clear to the point that nothing that was seen, heard, or witnessed, that transpired was to leave this building. You are not to say a word about it to your CO workers. And off base, you just forget everything that you may have seen or heard concerning this. It didn't happen. You got the impression that they would do bodily harm without really coming out and threatening you. These two suits gathered up all the developed and undeveloped film and all the materials that they had with it. My logbook, I never did see that again. When I got out, I received an official United States Navy document on the Navy letterhead. They gave me this document where, for 5 years, it was absolutely out of the question for me to leave the country under any circumstances whatsoever. And to leave the state of Virginia, I had to contact the Roanoke office of the FBI and let them know if I just wanted to cross the state line to go into North Carolina. And that was for 5 years after I was discharged. I also want to tell you about this member of my wife's family. Jack Booth is his name. He is dead now, but he was in the army and he was stationed at Roswell when the Roswell incident happened. He was my wife's uncle, my wife's mother's brother. He was from Bluefield, West Virginia. He said that when he was just a kid in the army, he was at Roswell, parenthesis, New Mexico, when this thing, whatever it was, crashed. And he was there pulling guard duty when they went out to the crash site. A truckload of them went to pick debris up and whatnot, and he was there when they actually did recover the bodies. He said, "I am telling you that they put little bitty guys in body bags and they weren't humans. They were just little odd-looking fellows. They were nothing like a human. And they put them in body bags and one or two of them were still alive. There were actual survivors from this crash according to him. They were picking up all the little pieces of the craft and he said that they actually put those guys down shoulder to shoulder on their hands and knees and went across the debris area picking up any little speck and scrap that they had. And they did it for days. He said that they were all threatened. He said they just came right out and said, 'Look, if you say anything about this you might just turn up missing tomorrow. It is time to end all secrecy on this as it no longer poses a national security threat. And make the technology available for use in the private sector.'" Dot Ben Rich, former head of Lockheed Skunk Works. UCLA School of Engineering alumni speech March 23, 1993 UFO secret file extraterrestrial moon bases testimonials, Edgar Mitchell, Apollo astronaut Don Phillips, U.S. Air Force and contractor at Lockheed Skunk Works and the CIA John Maynard, Defense Intelligence Agency Carl Wolf, U.S. Air Force Donna Hare, NASA contractor. Phil Coford. Commentary from Stephen M. Greer. There have been conspiracy theories galore about whether the moon landings actually happened, based upon one small segment of the broadcast of July 20, 1969 taken of the American flag ruffling in the wind as one of the two astronauts struggled to plant it. There is no air on the moon, therefore no wind. The truth is, the moon landing actually did take place, but that flag planting segment was filmed on Earth, on a sound stage in New York, I heard from one source. Why the deception? In preparing for the Apollo landings, NASA's flyover missions had taken photos of structures on the far side of the moon. Some of these were ancient, others pristine, and all were advanced and extraterrestrial. Not knowing what to expect, NASA officials had shot fake landing footage in order to jump cut just in case the ETs decided to throw Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin a welcome party. When the lunar module landed, the rim of the crater was crowded with ETVs, extraterrestrial vehicles. With the broadcast on a delay, NASA was able to cut to the pre-filmed footage, editing out the astronauts' reactions to their host's appearance. The astronauts have refused to speak about the moon bases and the ET's presence at the Apollo landings. Each was warned that disclosure of the truth would result in not only their own death, but the deaths of their loved ones. Neil Armstrong privately told a member of our team that we were actually warned off the moon. Why? When we speak of extraterrestrial intelligence, we are talking about advanced species possessing higher states of consciousness. For this reason, careful consideration must not only be given to our view of the ET's intentions, but more importantly, to our own intentions and attitudes. The human tendency, well evidenced by both military and civilian reactions to UFO's, has been xenophobic and violent. The human predisposition to view anything which we do not understand or cannot control as intrinsically hostile and threatening must be overcome. The blind quest for personal gain, profiteering and an inclination towards viewing ETV/ET in predominantly an acquisition framework needs to be altered. If we are motivated by a desire to outsmart ET and acquire their technology and energy source, then our efforts will fail. If we approach ET with greed, fear, hostility and suspicion, then we shall expend our efforts in vain. There is no doubt that we are dealing with beings who are capable of reading, by both telepathic and conventional means, our true intentions and motivations, and who can sense the spirit of our endeavor. Success, therefore, requires the spirit of our endeavor be one of scientific openness. The search for truth, altruism, selflessness, harmlessness and non-covetousness. A desire for the peaceful furtherance of the ET-human relationship is paramount. For these reasons, purity of motive on the part of human researchers and investigators is a primary requisite, while specific skills, expertise and technology are secondary considerations. The breadth and clarity of our consciousness is imperative and transcends all else. In this regard, it is likely that a novice possessed of noble intentions and equipped with only a flashlight would meet, and has met, with greater success than a governmental agency motivated by lesser intentions, even though it has advanced technology, personnel and billions of dollars at its disposal. Indeed, an aboriginal with only a bonfire may go further in the establishment of communication and the discovery of truth. In short, we were warned off the moon because we were going there as part of an arms race with the Soviet Union. Despite the nobility of JFK's challenge, the Apollo program was launched in response to the Soviet Union's Sputnik program. In essence, the lunar landings were a proxy for the Cold War. A highly militarized competitive venture between the two global nuclear powers. NASA's threat got to Buzz Aldrin, who suffered a nervous breakdown. But the space agency also had a breakdown. After only a few more lunar landings, and the ET's perturbed presence, the Apollo mission was scrubbed, replaced by the shuttle program. Six shuttles were built, two exploded and both crews perished. And at an average cost of $450 million per launch, the project was going nowhere fast. In its wake came Space Lab, a serve-no-purpose observation platform now being serviced by the Russians. Today, the entire US space program is being pushed towards privatization. What has NASA been doing? Why has it lacked direction ever since Apollo? The problem over the last 40 plus years is that there have been two space programs, NASA, which has been forced to use antiquated 1940s rocket technology, the equivalent of riding down the block on an explosive, and the real space program, a secret black ops funded venture using high voltage anti-gravitics propulsion systems reverse engineered from downed UFOs that are capable of taking ET home. That information came from Ben Rich, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works. The reason NASA lacks direction is because its scientists have been waiting every decade to retire the mules and bring the Maserati out of the garage. Michael Schrutt, a military aerospace historian, tells what he heard from Ben Rich: "We have things flying in the Nevada desert that are 50 years beyond what you can comprehend. If you've seen it on Star Wars or Star Trek, we've been there and done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort. And that's not coming from me, that's coming from Ben Rich, the head of Lockheed Skunk Works. As I stated in the introduction, the extraterrestrials have made it very clear that the entry ticket for human civilization to become interplanetary is first and foremost to be civilized, to live together peacefully, to renounce weapons of mass destruction, and to go out into space free of weapons systems with a consciousness of universal peace. Once we do this, the universe is going to open its arms wide open. Testimonial. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo astronaut, sixth man to walk on the moon. Yes, there have been ET visitations. There have been crashed craft. There has been materials and bodies recovered. And there is some group of people somewhere that may or may not be associated with the government at this point, but certainly were at one time, that have this knowledge. They have been attempting to conceal this knowledge or not permit it to be widely disseminated. I cannot answer who these people are. But there is a lot of evidence that points to what I call a clandestine group. People who have some quasi-affiliation with government and certain government facilities but operate in a very stealthy and secret way that is not generally under a high-level government control as far as I can tell. From all that I know, there have been ET visitations and may continue to be. There have been craft that have been recovered. There has been a certain amount of reverse engineering that has allowed some of these craft, or some components, to be duplicated. And yes, there are Earthlings who are utilizing some of this equipment in certain ways. As to whether it's been kept secret, it's been there all along. But it has been the subject of disinformation in order to deflect attention and to create confusion so the truth doesn't come out. Disinformation is simply another method of stonewalling. And that's been used consistently for the last 50 years or so, whether balloons over Roswell as opposed to a crashed craft of some sort. That is disinformation. We've seen that for 50 years. And it's the best way to hide something. It is becoming very clear that the way we have conducted ourselves as stewards of life on planet Earth is wanting. We have environmental, global problems right now that are bringing civilization to a crisis. And people don't want to hear that, but it's slowly becoming obvious that it is true. And so, this knowledge of who we are, how we manage a planet, how we fit into the larger scheme of things, is a very important question. Parenthesis. Our deepest gratitude goes to James Fox for sharing this interview. Testimonial. Don Phillips, U.S. Air Force and contractor at Lockheed Skunk Works and the CIA, worked with Kelly Johnson at the Lockheed Skunk Works on design and construction of the U-2 and the SR-71 Blackbird. He was in the Air Force at Las Vegas Air Force Base during a major UFO event. During the Apollo landing, Neil Armstrong says, "They're here. They are right over there and look at the size of those ships. And it is obvious. They don't like us being here." And he went on to describe a lineup of military planes, "Only here are these craft, and their people, observing them. Neil Armstrong," he said, "they don't want us to be here. I have the written communication." Testimonial. John Maynard was a military intelligence analyst for the Defense Intelligence Agency. While at the DIA, he became familiar with the compartmentalization process of maintaining secrecy. About weapons and space, I think that we can go back to a comment that was made by one of the astronauts when he stepped on the moon. It was the day after they got there, and it was the original flight, and he says, "You're right, they're already here." It got out on the airwaves. I know several people who recorded it. But the remark was very unique, because it was quickly taken out of all other tapes that were public broadcast. Testimonial. Carl Wolf had a top-secret crypto clearance while in the Air Force and worked with the Tactical Air Command at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia. "I was in the United States Air Force from January 18, 1964, until October 18, 1968. I had worked with Tactical Air Command at Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, the 4,444th Reconnaissance Technical Group. The group was involved in photographic reconnaissance. They were working with the U-2 planes, the spy satellite photography, before anyone knew we had it. At that point in time, no one knew we were doing spy satellite photography. Of course, no one knew we had the U-2 program operating, or what the capabilities of that program were. We also did gun camera and reconnaissance film from C-130s, all sorts of aircraft that were going into combat situations. We processed the film for that.